More big business deals announced today.
This time it's chips, drugs, and fingerprints.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hi, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, August 30th. We'll tell you about all that merger and acquisition buzz in just a moment. Also, a new list of the world's top global cities. And are you enjoying that street musician? You might want to give him a swipe. But first,
a burst of merger and acquisition activity today. The huge French drug maker Sanofi Aventis has made a bid for the American biotech firm Genzyme. Genzyme has said no so far. 3M is buying a company known for fingerprint identification. And the giant computer chip maker Intel will buy part of the German chip firm Infineon for $1.4 billion. Now, that move gets Intel into the lucrative smartphone market because Infineon makes the chips for the iPhone 4. Here's Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson with more.
Hi, Bill.
Why is this a big deal for Intel?
Well, Intel has been looking to expand its reach beyond just computers, and this will help in that regard because Infineon gives Intel a way into the smartphone market and specifically Apple's iPhone 4, which uses Infineon's chips. And by the way, Bill, it's not just Intel that is deal hungry right now. We heard today that the French company Sanofi Aventis made public its $18 billion offer for the U.S. biotech firm Genzyme. And I would like to say that I don't come up with these names. I just have to say them.
So all these mergers, Jeremy, how should the rest of us feel about this burst of deal making?
Well, we know companies are sitting on a lot of cash right now, so I guess it's a good thing that they're willing to get back into the game and start spending. But I spoke with Howard Wieldon, who's a senior strategist at BGC Partners in London, and here's what he said.
I've been in the industry over 40 years now, and I can't remember an acquisition that's actually led to an enhancement of jobs. Jobs will go as a result of M&A activity. It's as sure as night follows day.
But, Bill, despite layoffs initially, Wieldon says this activity probably means growth down the road. As he puts it, mergers and acquisitions are capitalism's way of saying it's moving on.
Moving on then. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson in New York. Thank you.
You're welcome, Bill.
Now, just because there's a merger doesn't mean it's going to be successful. Let's talk with senior U.S. economist Julia Coronado at BNP Paribas in New York. She joins us every Monday. Hi, Julia.
Good morning.
So I mentioned Intel buying part of this German chip maker, the French takeover offer for Genzyme, also 3M buying a company known for fingerprint identification. Julia, we've all heard about deals that don't work. What makes a good merger or acquisition?
Well, right now in the environment we're in, it's an extremely competitive environment with the economy recovering at a pretty lackluster pace. So companies are really focused on gaining market share, maintaining market share, looking for the areas that will be growth areas of the future. Hopefully that bodes well for the wave of mergers and acquisitions we're in. That contrasts with mergers and acquisitions that we see in boom times, where sometimes people just extrapolate those boom times forward and expect much more than is realistic from a merger. So hopefully this much more conservative approach will bode well for these deals.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Julia, the government said this morning both personal income and spending were up a little bit in July. Is that a hopeful sign?
I wouldn't say it's terribly hopeful. I think what the report reinforces is the dynamic we've been in, which is that, you know, consumers are spending, but they're spending very conservatively. They're still saving at a very high rate. They're allocating their dollars very cautiously. So it sort of confirms what we've been in, which is slow growth. So it's not that hopeful in the sense that we're not seeing spending that's strong enough to give businesses the confidence to run out and hire a whole new wave of workers.
Okay. Oh, well. Senior U.S. economist Julia Coronado at BNP Paribas. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Despite trillions of dollars in government stimulus and lower interest rates, the economy is only in a tepid recovery. Is it time for something new? Could changing the tax code spark some job creation? Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports from Washington.
A presidential advisory board has suggested some tax changes that could help the economy. The board didn't make any recommendations, but the head of the review committee, former Reagan economic advisor Martin Feldstein, was clear about what he thought is wrong.
The United States has a very high corporate tax rate, higher than any other industrial country than Japan.
Are corporate taxes keeping businesses from creating jobs? Stephen Enten heads a think tank on the economics of taxation. He says everything else the government's tried has been a waste.
If instead of spending all that money, they had cut the corporate income tax, renewed the Bush tax cuts, particularly the two top rates that fall on the people who are doing the bulk of small business investment, then you would have seen more investment by the private sector.
Resulting, he says, in more jobs. But economist Mark Zandi of Moody's Analytics says there's a faster way. Keep and expand a tax credit for businesses that hire the unemployed.
Make it more lucrative, bigger, and publicize it much better than they have the current one.
Zandi says the recovery is too fragile to allow the Bush income tax cuts to expire. He'd extend the cuts, even for the wealthy, until the economy gets going again. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, August 30th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. Japan's central bank held an emergency meeting today to try and do something about its economy and make the country's currency more competitive. And to make matters worse, China is now publicly criticizing Japanese companies for not paying their Chinese workers enough. Things are getting a little testy between the two, as Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
The back and forth between the two countries is all about resources, natural and human ones. Japan's foreign minister struck first, blaming Beijing for restricting exports of so-called rare earth metals. They're essential for Japan's high-tech industry. He also complained that striking Chinese workers are slowing factories down. China Premier Wen Jiabao shot back, warning Japanese companies that it was high time they give Chinese workers a raise. Japanese car makers Honda and Toyota had to interrupt assembly lines at their plants in China this year to deal with fed-up workers there. International relations expert Huang Dahui says this testy exchange is a symbol of China's growing economic power.
Japan is used to being the strongest country in Asia and has always looked down upon China. But now China is more powerful, and I think it's hard for the Japanese to accept this.
China may have a stronger economy than Japan, but Huang says it's basically quantity over quality. He says China could stand to learn from Japan's more mature economy. Not that it seemed very mature today. A rising yen is terrible news for Japan's export-driven economy. The currency is at a 15-year high against the dollar. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The French pharmaceutical drug giant Sanofi Aventis says it wants to buy the American drug company Genzyme for more than $18 billion. The French are turning up the pressure for the deal after the Americans rejected a smaller offer earlier this summer. More from Berlin and reporter Kyle James.
Genzyme is the world's largest maker of medicines for genetic diseases, but it's been hit by production problems over the past few years. Still, it's got two potential blockbuster drugs in the pipeline, one for multiple sclerosis, another for cholesterol. And that makes Genzyme a very attractive candidate to Sanofi. For one, big drug makers are increasingly looking towards biotech companies for future growth. And another reason is the French drug maker will soon lose a lot of revenue.
Many pharmaceutical companies are losing their patents on the big blockbusters.
Oliver Rakow is an analyst with Deutsche Bank Research. He says Sanofi is now facing generic competition on two of its best-selling drugs.
Therefore, they need acquisitions often of small innovative companies in order to increase their sales again.
While Sanofi's announcement falls short of a hostile bid, media reports say the company might take its offer directly to shareholders. The recent uptick in mergers and acquisitions is especially acute in the pharmaceutical field. Rakow says companies can't just hire more scientists, but need to join up with firms that have research teams and projects already in place. In Berlin, I'm Kyle James for Marketplace.
Some big cities just have a lot of clout when it comes to doing business. Big corporations, key decision makers, technology, transportation. This month, Foreign Policy magazine rated the 65 top global cities. New York is number one. Chicago and Los Angeles are in the top 10. Five are in Asia. Christina Larson is contributing editor at Foreign Policy. Welcome to Marketplace.
Good morning, Steve.
What makes a city global?
In order to be a global city, you need to have size, complexity, and diversity. So all of these cities are tied to people, places, and ideas outside of the cities themselves.
Your report highlights a lot of people in the future migrating from rural areas to more urban areas. Why is this happening?
Cities are where people and ideas mix, where innovation and change happen, where the jobs are. And from India to China to just about anywhere in the world, people are drawn to places where there's more opportunity. This isn't a new trend in history. I think what's new now is just how fast it's happening. And also how aware people are of it happening halfway around the world.
I was just mesmerized by this one little nugget that I found from this index, and that New York and London represent just about half, under half of the global market capitalization. And I thought that was just amazing. Two cities, two super global cities. Why should the West be concerned then about what's happening in China or in India, in these other places?
It's important to remember that while Asian cities are rising, and five of the top 10 cities in this year's Global Cities Index are from the Asia-Pacific region, while Asian cities are rising, they're still comparatively poor. I think it's important to point out that economic clout and market capitalization aren't the only measures of global influence. There are new political axes, trade networks, cultural norms, experiments in technology and sustainable living are happening all over the world, including, of course, in the East. And so we have to pay attention. We might even learn something that's worth trying back home.
Christina Larson, contributing editor at Foreign Policy Magazine. Thanks for the time.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, August 30th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, just go to the numbers at marketplace.org. President Obama is back at work this week after 10 days off in Martha's Vineyard. A lot of bad news came out while he was away. The housing market was way down. So were the numbers on economic growth for earlier this year. As Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains, the president's options for fixing the economy are limited.
Over at the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke says he's done about everything he can, and Congress doesn't seem interested in approving any new stimulus spending to jumpstart the economy, at least not before the November election. So what's a president to do?
He needs to talk about the economy. He needs to talk about what he is going to do to turn things around.
Quincy Crosby is a market strategist at Prudential Financial. She says the president should highlight his plans to help small business. The White House has proposed a small business lending initiative. Andrew Parmentier heads Height Analytics. He says the president can also talk about how the new health care and financial reform laws will affect businesses and consumers.
Let's not forget what's been done and what that's going to mean 6 to 12 months from now.
The president has been traveling around the country talking about how the economic stimulus money is being spent, but Parmentier says the president needs to make more public statements on the economy. He says the markets need to hear from the president on a regular basis. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
5 years ago today, New Orleans restaurants were closed. The city was full of water after Hurricane Katrina overtopped the levees. The only meals to be found were emergency rations. But New Orleans food culture has come back since the storm. Marketplace's Eve Tro met a family who found an unlikely way to keep their cooking alive.
It's 10:30 a.m. at the cafeteria of Loyola Law School in uptown New Orleans. The staff's preparing for the lunch rush.
So today for lunch, it's mustard greens, smothered pork chop, candied yams, cornbread.
Peggy Ratliff runs this kitchen. And no, this is not normal college fare. Ratliff and her mother, Celestine Dunbar, used to have a soul food restaurant called Dunbar's Creole Cooking.
It was family. You just can just come in, put your arms on the table, get your fingers greasy, and so it was just home.
The restaurant was destroyed by Hurricane Katrina. The family business was closed until Dunbar had an idea. She called universities to ask if they needed help running their kitchens. Ratliff says they landed the law school contract a few weeks later.
Well, it looked like we would have been out of the restaurant business if Loyola wouldn't have opened up their doors to her so generously.
It was a deal specific to post-Katrina New Orleans, when creative partnerships were vital. Liz Williams directs the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. She says Katrina drove out many corporate food franchises.
In their place came up all those little mom-and-pop places that had been displaced. So now we have more restaurants that are owned locally than before Hurricane Katrina.
And Peggy Ratliff says local cooks are more appreciated, too.
Now people are more conscious of preserving the food culture here.
Dunbar's may be the only Creole restaurant on a college campus.
So she's doing fried chicken.
And the family members plan to keep the cafeteria contract, but they also want to serve their old neighborhood again. It's about a mile away, called Ferret. Peggy Ratliff doesn't know when that will happen.
It's not clear yet. By being closed so long, you have to redo the whole building, the plumbing, the electric. Just don't have the funds.
There is a difference, she says, between finding stability and truly rebuilding. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
This morning in a Los Angeles courtroom begins the divorce proceedings that will determine whether Jamie or Frank McCourt owns the LA Dodgers. At issue, whether documents prove ownership of the team worth $750 million. Here to help us sort out what we're likely to see in that courtroom and what history tells us about divorce cases such as this is Scott Altman, a law professor at the USC Gould School of Law. Professor, thanks for being here.
Pleasure.
The couple's dispute centers around this agreement that they both signed way back in 2004. What exactly is at issue here?
Well, there's two elements of dispute. One is Mrs. McCourt says she didn't read the document and she was led to believe it only concerned liabilities that might be settled with creditors and not the divorce. And the second is she says because of inconsistencies in the document, it should be thrown out altogether. The first draft said that Mr. McCourt would keep anything in his name except the Dodgers in case of divorce. A later draft said he would keep anything in his name, including the Dodgers, in case of divorce.
Now, I can think of many contracts I'd like to get out of, Professor, where
yeah.
I say, well, I didn't read the contract. I mean, is that a legal maneuver?
Well, no, just saying that you didn't read the contract is certainly not sufficient. But her first argument is that she was led to believe before she signed it that it had nothing to do with what would happen in case of divorce. And the question is, was she misled into believing that by Mr. McCourt, or was she, because she's a sophisticated person, she's a lawyer, she has advanced degrees, going to be held responsible for the document she signed?
And how long will this fight take?
I think that really depends on how much testimony the judge is going to allow in this case. These are really factual questions. Exactly what did she know about the document? What was she told? Who told her these things? And presumably they're going to be presenting witnesses who will testify as to precisely what was said.
We'll have to wrap it up there. Professor Scott Altman, we do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Scott Altman, professor of law at the USC Gould School of Law. Thanks for your time. And finally, you're walking past a street musician, the guy sounds pretty good, but you don't have any change to throw into his guitar case. That's no longer an excuse. The British bank Barclays has tricked out the guitar of a London busker with what it calls contactless technology. Passersby need only wave a credit card over the guitar to make a donation.
I think the catchphrase of this recession might be, "Brother, can you spare a swipe?" In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.